Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, January 3rd, 2013. I cannot believe it. We are here, and anyway, I'm certainly glad that 2012 is over with all of the misinformation puppets of the government running around saying the world was going to end, the NASA white hats coming in to save the day. Anyway, I'm sure glad all that's over, and it certainly was a huge waste for many of years of my time, but it called a lot of attention to my work, and a lot of people are really understanding the real message now of what's going on, that there is a real story to Planet X, and that was a lot of misinformation. But the one thing you can learn from this is how much effort, unbelievable amount of effort, placed in misinformation to misguide the public. And that's all it ever was. That was all it ever was created and manipulated and managed to misinform, misguide, and throw a curveball at the public. So if you understand that, you've learned a lot. What you've learned is how much effort, time, money, Hollywood, little puppets running around, NASA coming in, all the coordination that it took to coordinate that massive misinformation campaign, misuse of the Mayan calendar, of everything else under the sun. But look at all of the effort that it took to do that. And I think the vast majority of people have already forgotten it and will be very glad to have forgotten it. But, and so I think all in all, it did two things. It might fool a few people, and there'll be people running around saying, well, I'm sure glad that that's ended. Certainly there's one person that is very glad it's all over, and that's me. Because the one thing you found that was undercurrent in all of the 2012 end of the world BS, and that's all you can call it, was the destruction or the attempted destruction of my work. The people trying to manipulate it and change it. People writing series of books deceptively similar to mine. So I can say that I guess the one thing I can say is it was a lot of the effort was to dissuade my work, to try and... So at any rate, I guess that tells me that I'm succeeding. That tells me that there are people out there that are very afraid of my message, and would go to that length to try and destroy it. So, but anyway, this is something that I've been at for many, many decades. My paper trail is there. My radio shows going back decades with top talk show hosts giving the same message, and of course adding to it, adding my more recent work, but keeping the public informed, but being very consistent over the decades. And that's one of my hallmarks, that's why in my books, the appendices show my earliest work, going back to the 1970s, the early comet work. And so the one thing you'll see about me is I'm consistent. I've built on my past work. Okay, enough of that, but there are some things to be learned from all of this. This past week, they announced a NASA special, First Man on the Moon honoring Neil Armstrong. And, of course, you all know my opinion, if you've listened to my work, about the lunar landing or alleged lunar landings. My official statement, and I'm asked many times in public, because of my criticism of NASA and an ongoing, open criticism of NASA, people ask me, what's my opinion of the moon landing? And I simply say that it is highly, highly, highly questionable, and I've pointed out many issues. I'm not going to go into that tonight. But it's very simple. As a scientist, or looking at a scientific claim, I'm the scientist, I'm looking at a scientific claim of NASA claiming they went to the moon. Any scientific claim would require third-party verification. Independent third-party verification. It's required of any scientific claim. But NASA gets away without any of this. They publish in the journal Science, the journal Nature. They put out information on the BBC, on the American news networks. And there's no questioning, there's no independent verification of anything they say. And so the lunar landing is the epitome of NASA claims that of making scientific achievements. And so what would this require? This would require an independent country like Japan or another country to go there and take pictures of the areas and literally verify that the United States went to the moon. And if this can be done, it would lend credence to the NASA claim that they landed a man on the moon and subsequently landed numerous men on the moon, Apollo 7 and beyond with Neil Armstrong, etc. But there is literally no independent verification that the United States NASA ever went to the moon. There are many, 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 many reasons to believe they didn't, that they did not. So at any rate, but the main point of this is that NASA is still living the old glory days. It's like you scored the winning touchdown in high school in a big game. Now you're, you know, 55 years old and you're still down at the bar talking about the, you know, the guy that threw the ball and the guy that received it and the glory days. You know, like, give it a rest. Yeah, we all love those moments. We all cherish them. But NASA is living on its laurels and highly questionable laurels. At least the football score is verifiable. The landing on the moon has not been verified independently. But NASA live in the glory days. Trying to maintain some amount of semblance of respectability with the public. And I think that's getting harder and harder to do. They have to bolster their illusion of grandeur with the public because this year is going to be a bad year for NASA, especially in space science, because they're already out there doing severe damage control, preemptive damage control a whole year in advance regarding this comet, 2012 S1. Okay, so enough of that. Tonight, the main science topic, and I'm going to go right into it tonight, I'm going to spend a lot more time on my show doing pure science. So I want to let you know that. But these announcements do come up, and it's important to learn from them. It's important to learn the big lessons, and I try and point that out. Not dwelling on the negative, not dwelling on the pure BS side of all of this, but dwelling on the lessons that you should be learning from them. The amount of disinformation in the 2012 campaign, the amount of effort, or the glory days, NASA getting ready, bolstering its image, because they have to do something when these comets show up this year, especially the big one, that we're expecting to fill up the whole sky and put on a light show for the whole world. They're going to have their hands full trying to convince people that that's just a little dirty snowball up there. Okay, so anyway, tonight's main science topic, how big is a comet? How big is a comet? And that's a big question. It has many facets, so I'm going to dive right into that right now. And that's very important, because this whole aspect of comets being out in the solar system, and it's a term I coined in my original work, action at a distance. Action at a distance signifies the the activity in outer space where things can affect something else at a distance. The moon affects us at a distance. The moon has a big effect on us on Earth, and it's a 250,000 miles away. In terms of outer space, we use that distance as kind of a measuring stick, 250,000 miles away, the moon. One lunar distance. And so we kind of know what the moon can do from that distance. It's moving relatively slowly around the Earth in its orbit around Earth. The moon is moving relatively slowly. Things that fly by us in outer space, like asteroids, every now and then an asteroid comes by and whizzes by and coming much, much faster than the movement of our moon. The moon is locked in an orbit. It takes about 28 days, 27 days, something, to move around in its orbit once around the Earth. But the asteroids sometimes come whizzing by, and they'll be by in, 4 or 5 hours. And so what if the asteroids that came whizzing by were big, like the size of Jupiter? I have spent many shows in some a series of lectures on shows talking about the effects of large objects in outer space that come near planet Earth or the other planets, what the effect is. And I would take an object of various size, of various distance from a planet, and, okay, here are the effects that you could expect, all the way up to... And those shows I did a number of years ago, a series of shows on the effects of large objects coming by. But mainly those shows, I was dealing with gravitational effects. Tonight's show, I'm going to be dealing with how big is a comet. And, okay, so let me just kind of describe physically what we call a comet. First of all, you have the nucleus, which is the solid, rocky part in the center. And then there's a whole laundry list of plasma effects that surround the nucleus. They are much bigger. The physical nucleus of the comet is relatively small, typically. They're in the range of a few miles across, a few kilometers across, up to maybe 10 kilometers across. Halley's Comet, which is a typical small comet, the nucleus is well documented. It's about 7 miles. It's kind of a potato-shaped object about 7 miles in length, about the size of the island of Manhattan, cross-section of the Halley's Comet. There are other comet nuclei that can be planet-size, but very, very simply, any object that comes into the solar system, whether it's a piece of dust or bigger than Jupiter, they all have one characteristic. They all discharge the solar capacitor. And this, for people who are new to this show, basically this is the center core part of my work. I discovered that the solar wind, this wind of plasma charged particles that comes off our sun constantly, or any object, galactic nucleus, quasar, star, what have you, that is undergoing the fusion process. Part of that process is to separate charge. The end result of it is that there is an excess current of positive charge coming off the object and leaving in the form of a wind, and that causes a differential electric field around the object, and it's somewhat like the backyard bug killer zapper, as it's called, where a bug flies between two electric plates and the discharge zaps the bug and kills the bug, and that's used as a backyard bug killer. This is something that is many people are familiar with. That's why I use it as an example. This outer space is the same, but the thing causing the charge in the plasma field out there is the sun. So the sun not only gives off light, it gives off charged particles in the form of a wind, and that wind has a differential charge density. There are more protons and positively charged particles coming off than electrons, and this is just part of the fusion process. but that leaves the solar system with a net negative charge in the center where the sun is, and the sun is a very complex fusion battery engine. But the end result is that all of the objects that float around out in the solar system, the Earth included, discharge this solar capacitor. The Earth discharges it less than a comet because Earth is in a circular orbit, and so we're cutting through basically, we're rotating around the sun at a very similar voltage state, you might call it, in outer space. So we don't discharge the solar capacitor that much. The same is true of all the planets. But we do discharge that, and it causes a lot of our weather. It has a great effect on our weather. But comets come in more of an angle, so to speak, breaking through that solar capacitor, and they're more like the bug. They cause a much bigger discharge. Let's take an example of a bug in the backyard, bug killer. Let's put the bug in there before you plug in the power cord. What's going to happen? Oddly enough, it's not going to discharge. The bug is not going to discharge the capacitor the same way it's going to discharge if the bug flies into the capacitor when the capacitor is on. If the backyard bug killer, once again, if it's unplugged, you put a bug in between the charged plates and then plug it in, it's not going to discharge that capacitor. It requires the bug coming in from outside, and it's like sticking your finger or a wire in there. It creates an extension, so to speak, of the potential out at the edge, the electrical potential, and it causes the discharge to start. And once that discharge starts, it starts to discharge the local capacitor in its region. It's always regional. But some of the big comets can stretch all the way across the solar system and start discharging the entire capacitor. And this is where the big, powerful comets come in. So there is a light that's given off, a luminosity that's given off by comets. And this is something that standard science does not want to talk about. They don't want to talk about the luminosity of comets, the fact that comets give off light like a light bulb. They are actually lighting up. Why don't they talk about it? Because their dirty snowball comet model cannot account for this. That cannot account for a vast amount of energy lighting up all the gas out there in the comet tail. It can't account for that. So they don't talk about that. They pretend that it doesn't happen. So one of the main luminosity characteristics of a comet, especially a powerful comet, is that it gives off light, much more light than it receives from the sun. And the dirty snowball comet model, the NASA promoted comet model, which is a complete fairy tale science, it cannot account for some of the main characteristics of comets. So they just don't talk about it. They pretend they're not there. But let's talk about the shape and size of some of these plasma effects. And so I'm going to use four examples here throughout my discussion. First of all, I'm going to use a comet nucleus that's, let's say, a half a mile across, pretty small one. And then we could also go way down to the baseball-sized object that would be the nucleus of a very small comet. They are all comets. Anything that discharges the solar capacitor, including the Earth, is a comet. So there's a crossover between planets and comets. It's just that the Earth doesn't discharge the solar capacitor very much, and therefore we don't get the big, extensive, visible tail. But I'll tell you, we've seen planet Venus a number of times develop a tail. Recorded, established observation where Venus develops a tail. And that's when solar conditions are right. We know that all of the planets have what they call magnetotails. And, of course, that's a misrepresentation of the facts in standard science. It's really a portion of that electrical discharge. Okay, so let's look at the nuclear size of the comet. This is the rocky part in the center. So let's take one a half a mile across. Let's take one 7 miles across, something like Halley's Comet, a fairly small one. And then let's take one about the size of, let's say a 30-mile across nucleus. And then let's go up to one, a big one. Let's go up to something that has a nucleus the size of a planet, a big planet, something, let's say Saturn, something the size of Saturn. And, of course, they could be much, much bigger. They could be much bigger than Jupiter. But here's something that I've learned over the years in studying comets, studying nuclei. And by the way, NASA can measure these directly using radio signals. They can get in and look through the atmosphere of a comet and measure directly, but they never give that data out. They always give some other estimate. Some guy sits in an office who claims to be an expert and twiddles his pen for a few minutes and possibly has a rabbit's hat, a hat with a rabbit in it, but pulls out some numbers at random and then says this is how big the comet nucleus should be. We know for a fact that comet nuclei are planet-sized. Comet Lovejoy is a perfect example. Comet went through the solar atmosphere. NASA thought it would disintegrate and were ready to proclaim it a dead comet. When the nucleus comes charging out the other side of the comet, after passing through the sun, and brilliant up in the morning sky right next to the sun is the nucleus. No tail had formed yet, but it's bigger, much bigger than the planet Mercury. And of course, NASA says it's a whopping 600 meters across. All misinformation. And I keep throwing that in there because I have to prepare the public for the misinformation they're going to be given this year about the comet coming in C2012 S1. But our comet sizes are 0.5 mile, 7 miles, 30 miles, and then something the size of Saturn, tens of thousands of miles in diameter. Okay, now what I've learned over the years is that the bigger the nucleus, the bigger the discharge. And there's a reason for this. Once the discharge starts to occur, and just like the bug zapper, the discharge always occurs where the rock is. The thing causing the discharge is always in line of that discharge in the solar capacitor. But the bigger nuclei have much more surface area, so they can maintain a much larger charge on the surface. And so it's as simple as that. Purely electrical, purely an issue of size of the nucleus. And so let's look at the surface amount of surface on a comet nucleus. It goes up as the square of the radius. So if you double the size of the nucleus, the diameter of the nucleus, you're going to go up by a factor of 4 on the surface area. So let's say you go from something that's 30 miles in diameter to 300 miles in diameter in terms of a nucleus. That's a factor of 10 in diameter, but the surface area goes up by a factor of 100. Now let's go from something 30 miles in diameter all the way up to something that is, let's say, 30,000 miles in diameter, something that's getting up towards Jupiter size or bigger. All of a sudden, you have a million times more capacity to hold charge on that nucleus than the littler one. And if you go down all the way to something that's, say, 3 miles across, the smallest nucleus, you're talking about a factor of 10,000 squared. You can see you're talking 100 million times the amount of charge capacity on that comet nucleus. So the bigger nuclei, the simple result is the bigger the nucleus, it has squared, basically a squared potential, it's a squared factor, more ability to hold charge, and therefore the tail is going to be much bigger, the material being attracted into the nucleus is going to be much bigger. That's the visible part you see of a comet. And it could be, and the smaller comets can be 100,000 miles to up to 3-4 million miles across. Just the cross-section across the comet tail. So the big comet nuclei, the tails could get up to 20 to 30 million miles across. So these I'm just giving you some of these distances because they're going to come into play here, as some of these comets this coming year are going to be coming this close to planets. For example, comet C2012S1 will come within 7 million miles of Mars in the early part of October next year. And it's rather comical to see the antics of NASA when they're doing their damage control misinformation articles. They never mention Mars. They don't. They say, don't bother looking until November of next year when it's up in the sky. They don't want the public looking at Mars. They clearly do not want anything to do with this, because for the first time in many thousands of years, we're going to have a comet that is coming close to a planet, a major planet, our next nearest neighbor out the planet Mars. 7 million miles, if this is a big comet, which it's said to be a large comet, and so I think that the nucleus is probably planet-sized. NASA says officially 26 miles across, and I don't quite believe them. I just know that they're lying about that. And that's one of the standard lies of NASA, is these nucleus, the size of the nucleus of the comets. So the nucleus of this comet, just estimating from the lies that NASA has put out in the past, if they say it's 26 miles across, I would put it at a probably around 2,600 miles across, a factor of 100 minimum. Possibly more, possibly a factor of 200, making it about 5,000 miles across, or Earth size, getting up towards the size of Earth, or certainly bigger than Mars itself. Okay, that's very important, because Mars is not that big a planet. It lost its atmosphere and oceans thousands of years ago when the large protoplanet Venus came by. Venus, the nucleus of Venus at that time, the comet Venus, before it became a planet Venus, the nucleus was larger than the planet Mars. So once an electrical connection was made between the comet and Mars, which is reported by the ancients, Mars prior to that had been a water planet, a blue planet. And so once that electrical connection is made, now it's a tug of war of gravity. Which object, the comet nucleus or the planet, has the larger surface gravity? Because the plasma is now free to flow between them. And once the tug of war begins, the bigger object is going to win. And so, by the way, when Venus came by Earth on two occasions, we experienced a major pollution event. The rain of fire and naphtha is very clear that we gained a lot of oil, and the meteor stream that came in from Venus on two occasions, the ancients talk about that. They're very clear about that, the burning fire and naphtha that fell out of the sky. Remember that the Noah's flood was thousands of years earlier, and that was primarily a comet event where the water came in. It was a worldwide flood. And I noticed last week, I was just listening before my show on WWCR. I was listening to the show prior to mine, and I was pleased to hear a guy talking about, and I just came in at the end, so I didn't know his name or all of the references, but he was talking about the fact that in the records in the British, in the Museum of London, they have records of the oldest map in the world, which had Noah's name on it, and they have the other information about the Ark, and showing that it was a worldwide flood. It wasn't just some local rainstorm that happened to last for 40 days and 40 nights. It was a worldwide storm. And, of course, the curator of the British Museum said, well, now we believe that this was just a local event, because they were primitive, stupid people, and they couldn't have known that the world was big and round, but that's really a more fairy tale science, trying to minimize the idea that those the intelligence of those people. Clearly, they knew about the world. There was seafaring. The ancient Phoenician mariners knew about the world. That's where the Columbus, the Perry Reese map, those maps came from the ancient Phoenician mariners who knew that the world was round. And there was an open channel where the North Pole polar cap is now, and that was during the days of Atlantis. So at any rate, just a little side story there. But the Noah's Flood, a worldwide flood, but now standard science and standard knowledge, as it's called, Western knowledge, tries to minimize that and pretend like it was just a local event where just torrential rain for 40 days and 40 nights and Noah built his ark and just floated around on the local area where it was flooding. It's the concept is so absurd. We know that the ocean levels rose hundreds and hundreds, as much as certainly as much as 200 feet, as much as 600 feet in the past 10,000 years. So the Earth has been inundated a number of times. And, of course, that's due to the Earth passing through large comet tails, not the little Halley's comet tail. I always love astronomers. Standard astronomers try and minimize the effect of comets by expressing that in 1910, Earth passed through the tail of Halley's Comet and nothing happened. Well, Halley's Comet is a little puffball of a comet and certainly in no way, shape, or form can be compared to the big comets, the big ancient comets, the kind that we might see in the solar system in the future. And as I said, they're certainly doing damage control on C2012S1, the comet that is already in the solar system. It's out by Jupiter. And remember that January 15th is coming up here right around the corner. The question is, will we hook into that electrical alignment and will it affect Earth weather? So here we are the third, and that's within 2 weeks. So that would be the 3rd, 17th, that'd be 2 weeks, might show 2 weeks from now is on the 17th. So then that's a Thursday night. So look at Tuesday, Monday, Sunday, anytime in that time frame before the 15th. And, of course, the new moon passing can help trigger some of that weather effect on Earth. At any rate, let's get back to this concept of how big is a comet. This comet, C2012S1, if it develops into the comet that I think it can, according to, and by the way, I'm using NASA predictions, and I think they are already doing damage control because they know that this comet is big, is headed in, and frankly, I know that they've been watching this comet for years coming in. It just was odd that they made the announcement of this comet on September 21st. Of this year, very strange timing, but they had to get that message out there so they could start doing their damage control. And before it would be discovered by some amateur go through the same routine as Hale-Bopp. Okay, so at any rate, this is something interesting, by the way, that came out in a news brief this past week. It was one of those news briefs where NASA was doing damage control. I think it was published at the BBC. But anyway, they said it's swirling. And they're talking about swirling jets. Well, swirling means it has a companion. And so I think they've been watching this object coming in. It has a companion. And the rate of spin, the periodicity of that companion's orbit, can tell you directly using a simple equation of astronomy, can tell you the mass of the central nucleus. But, of course, none of this data is available. NASA clearly has been watching this with the Hubble Space Telescope, but once again, none of that data being made public. Okay, so 7 million miles it will pass from the planet Mars, slightly above the planet Mars, and as I said before, I will have charts and graphs and everything available to the public on my webpage for free as these dates approach, telling you where to look, what to look for, what time to set your alarm clock, what kind of equipment you will need exactly where to look in the sky when you get up in the morning early before dawn to see Mars and this comet encounter. But it will be slightly above Mars in the early morning sky. Beautiful, clear night with no moon. You couldn't ask for a better visibility. So at any rate, how much is 7 million miles in terms of a comet? Well, the Ulysses spacecraft detected 90 million miles away, one comet, I think it was Comet Lovejoy, detected the effects of Comet Lovejoy 90 million miles away. That's about, a good 12 times or more the distance that this comet will be from Mars. So could we see some plasma connection between this comet and Mars? The answer is definitive yes. That very possibly in the morning sky we could see some plasma activity between Mars. And this is, of course, why NASA does not want anything to do with announcements with this comet and Mars. They're going to try their best to ignore that. They want to tell you that, don't bother looking until November after it's already passed by Mars. But I guarantee you, if this lights up the show with Mars, this could be something that has not been seen for many thousands of years, the direct interaction of a comet with Mars. And this could actually start, by the way, the closest approach of Mars with the comet will be on October 1st, 2013, so it's coming up this October. But weeks and weeks in advance of that, comet will be out on the outward side of Mars, and it could start interacting with Mars' atmosphere as early as early September next year. That'll be interesting to see. And once those connections start, Mars could go through some contortions. We could see terraforming on Mars. We could see other activity on the planet Mars. And this would be visible to, I don't know if it will be naked eye visible, but it'll be certainly visible with very minimal equipment like binoculars. So one thing that you might want to do is get a good set of astronomical binoculars and a tripod. Now, the astronomical binoculars are simply binoculars that have a good coating. I would recommend 50 millimeter lenses. Those are the big outer lenses of binoculars. With coatings, go to a place online. Any place that sells astronomical equipment can set you up with a good pair of astronomical binoculars. They know what you're looking for. And then spend a little extra on the tripod. Make sure that the tripod is very sturdy so that you can hands-free. You'll have a nice clear view of the morning sky. And if you want to spend a little more, you don't have to spend a lot of money to get a pretty nice big set of binoculars. My favorite set of binoculars, in local areas, I've got a pair of binoculars that have 100 millimeter lenses, and they weigh about 20 pounds, I think. They're 10 to 20 pounds. They're big. And so I have a big, heavy tripod to put them on. But let me tell you, that it has their 25 power, and they bring in the night sky. They're very clear, very bright, well-coated optics, all of the optics in the binoculars. So those are my favorite, and I guarantee you that's what I will be using. And the great thing about this is you don't have to travel. You don't have to make a trip any place except out into the country where you have nice, clear skies. Away from the city lights. And as I said, the moon will be out of the picture. Now let me describe the parts of a comet. The tail of the comet I've already talked about, that's the long, sweeping, flowing tail part. But there are other parts to a comet. There's something called a type 2 tail. And this is actually an extension of the entire plasma discharge. It starts way to the sunward side of the comet. It's basically an electron beam that passes away from the sun, and this is the main charge carrier in the comet. it's passing through, hits the comet nucleus, wraps around it, and then it keeps going out into outer space beyond. In these tails, the type 2 tails, their thin plasma tail, can sometimes be as much as 100 to 200 million miles long. In other words, twice the distance from Earth to the Sun. Now that's a long ways in outer space. So these type 2 tails, you can either be on the anti-sunward side, or you can be on the sunward side and connect into this plasma discharge. So this is something that's one of the biggest aspects of a comet. There's another thing that has been observable that has been viewed with comets. I call them the horns of the bull, but it's a plasma effect that you have. They're kind of reverse tails, and if you look at a comet that has these, it's kind of a cone that forms in the sunward direction around the nucleus, and it allows positive charge coming from the solar wind to funnel into the nucleus of the comet. And it's kind of like a big circular cone, but as you're looking at the side of the comet, it's most visible. It looks like horns. It looks like the horns of a bull, literally, and that gives the historical references to the bull, the horns of the bull. Those are the references you get in the ancient documents when they're talking about the comets. And then, of course, the sunward spike comes out the middle of that. Quetzalcoatl, which was the representation of the Maya dealing with the comet Venus, always has the tongue sticking way out of the serpent god, Quetzalcoatl. It always very, very much illuminates the tongue aspect of Quetzalcoatl. That represents the sunward spike. Now, there's one other component of a comet which is not going to be visible, and that is a hydrogen cloud. It's a positively charged hydrogen molecule that surrounds the comet nucleus. The hydrogen becomes positively ionized, and it's the atom that's most prominent in outer space. And so this is the shield. It's an electric shield, basically. And this is what happens to any charged object in outer space. It has a large, and these could be up to, let's say in a comet like C2012S1, let's say that the nucleus of comet C2012S1 is of the 3,000-mile diameter variety, which is probably about a correct estimate, given the level of lies in NASA's past history. Let's say that the visible atmosphere of this comet would be about 10 million miles across, giving it a radius of about 5 million miles. But remember, if the noseward side of this comet, the type 1 tail in the electron beam, could be up to, let's make an estimate, 50 million miles to the sunward side and then 50 million miles to the tail side. That means it's going to be hooking into Mars and connecting electrically with Mars, as I said, as much as a month before it even arrives for the closest approach of the nucleus. So when they say the closest approach, October 1st of next year, of 7 million miles, they're talking about the nucleus. The nucleus of the comet, if it doesn't change its orbit, will come within about 7 million miles. The coma, the tail part of the comet, could very much contact Mars. Remember, Mars has a plasma sheath also. So if these connect, and just because of the way this is coming in on its orbit, it's very likely that these will already be electrically connected long before the comet ever gets moves above the planet Mars. But the thing that's more important here than any of these is that the fact that this hydrogen shielding cloud, which, let me put it at conservatively 15 million mile diameter, that, and it's very diffuse, But once Mars gets inside of that, that's when the electrical activity can start. That's when Mars will be like the bug in the bug zapper, discharging that local capacitor of the comet and starting to connect electrically to the nucleus. This is where we could see some serious terraforming on Mars, sulfur dioxide coming all the way from Jupiter to hook into the Martian atmosphere. We could see Mars losing its atmosphere again. We don't know. We don't know what, if the nucleus of the comet is bigger than Mars, which it possibly is, we could see Mars losing its atmosphere. If Mars is bigger than the comet nucleus, then we could see Mars having a tremendous atmospheric boost, a tremendous, what we might call a pollution event. And so now you're starting to understand the point of this show. How big is a comet? Well, you have to understand all the various components of a comet. And then you can start to talk about how big it is. In what direction is it big? Some of these various components are much bigger than others, but only in a certain direction. So how big is a comet? Well, is it the nucleus? Is it the plasma cloud around it, the hydrogen cloud? Are you talking about the sunward spike? Are you going to be out in that type 2 tail area? Are you going to be in the regular tail of the comet? Are you going to be in, there's another aspect of comet nuclei, and this is when the positively charged ions come into the nucleus of the comet. If the comet nucleus has enough gravitational pull, it will maintain that atmosphere in the region. These atoms and molecules become neutralized because the nucleus area of the comet is very much electron rich. And so any ions that come racing in will be neutralized. Some of these will blow out in the solar wind, and that's what NASA scientists have mistakenly called the trailings of the Dirty Snowball Comet model. They measure these with their spacecraft. They call them neutrals. And this is really, that's what they are. They are neutral atoms, atoms that have been neutralized after they've been pulled in ion form into the nuclear area. And on the small comets, the real small comets that NASA has been near, at least the official announcements of NASA, we know that they've been out near other big comets, but the hush-hush is on that. They don't want to talk about any of that data. There are a lot of secret missions that never get out to the public that NASA has conducted, the Tier 1 science, and, of course, none of that information reaches the public. The garbage science they pawn off on the public, the Dirty Snowball Comet model, that's all the fluff science to keep the public stupid. But at any rate, the ionized hydrogen cloud that surrounds the comet easily could be 20, 25, 30 million miles across, which means that Mars will definitely be within that, and NASA, within its estimates, I'm sure has made those calculations, and that's why they don't want to say anything. They don't want the public looking there. Now, in terms of these numbers, I'm trying to use specific examples. Comet Hyakutake, for example, was a small but very powerful comet. It was a relatively medium-sized comet, I would say, but very, very bright. Now, this happens when comets, just like any other phenomena in space, they can be variable, and Comet Hyakutake, for some reason, really lit up the sky. And that's one of the toughest ones for NASA scientists to hide because it was really lit up like a light bulb. It was really brilliant. It was brilliant. And that's the one they discovered the X-rays in comets. 1996, that's when they discovered the X-rays in comets, confirming my original prediction that there would be X-rays to the sunward side of comet nuclei. And I get a kick out of some of these web pages where they have the false Velikovsky supporters arguing with NASA scientists, and of course they never allow my work to be quoted there. It's rather humorous to watch. It's almost screams of negligence, but of course they've set up NASA supports the phony Electric Universe pages so they don't have to allow my work, so they have something to point to. and not have to quote my work. So there's this part of the dog and pony show to keep the public stupid, to keep the public trying to look in the wrong direction and not have to talk about my work directly, because I'm the one that predicted X-rays and comets. It's right in my papers. I quote that in the three-part comet paper, which is in the appendix of the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes books. You look in there, and I say specifically, and I go through a whole discussion of why, there will be high-energy radiation to the sunward side of comet nuclei, especially in the more powerful luminous comets, and that this will be due to the electron beam on the sunward side of the comet nucleus in the overall solar capacitor discharge that caused by the comet nucleus. It's right there. It talks exactly about the X-rays. In 1996, they were discovered, and NASA went through a whole series of iterations to try and distort that topic, talking about charge exchange, something so absurd. Why would a little dirty snowball cause charge exchange to the sunward side and something big like Earth doesn't? It's so absurd. Once again, there's no refereeing of any of these articles about charge exchange or whatever. It's just absurdity placed upon more absurdity. Band-aids upon band-aids, spinning wheels upon spinning wheels to make the standard theories fit. But at any rate, now let's talk about C2012S1 and Earth. The closest this will get to Earth is going to be next November, is the date that's provided. It doesn't change its orbit drastically after it goes around the Sun. If it comes by Mars, it could have its orbit changed there. I don't know. NASA has not been real clear about the potential for orbital changes, and of course the tail drag on this comet could have a vast effect over the year and a half it's going to take this comet to get from Jupiter all the way in towards the Sun. The tail drag could slow this thing down to where it's going to whip around the Sun and come much closer to Earth than the 38 million mile prediction, because they're not accounting for any of these factors. I'm not saying it's going to, because we just don't have enough data to make any predictions, but the official predicted distance, closest approach distance, of the comet C2012S1 is around 38 million miles. Okay, now let's go back to the size of comets. The size of the coma of the comet might be a number of millions of miles across. That's not going to make it all the way to Earth. We're going to have a nice broadside view. We should be able to see the sunward spike on this comet, and especially at being very active after passing around the Sun. And, of course, the broadside view is very important, because with the broadside view, the NASA standard explanation for a sunward spike is that it's an optical illusion. It's really an anti-sunward tail, but because of the angle of the observer, it only looks like a sunward spike. That's the standard explanation. Well, on a broadside view, that explanation falls apart. And so we're going to have a beautiful broadside view of this comet in November of next year, proving to everybody once again that the NASA theories piecemeal fall apart. But is 38 million miles close? Is it going to connect to our atmosphere? It's iffy. It's very iffy. But the hydrogen cloud, now once again, we're talking about the various sizes of the various components of the comet plasma, and 38 million miles could put us within range of that hydrogen cloud, which could mean Earth could start to connect electrically with the comet during that closest approach. We could have auroras, we could have weather, we could have other things connecting into the comet, and then as the comet moves back and upwards behind us, behind Earth, we are going to have a very special electrical alignment January 10th to the 15th of 2014. I've already talked extensively about this, but now that's going to be when the comet is not that far behind us. just a little bit out and above us in January. The comet will not be all that far away, probably about 50 million miles. But remember that the type 2 tail and then the sunward spike can go out as much as 100 to 200 million miles. This is why I'm talking about the size of a comet. How big is a comet? Because it depends on what aspect of the comet you're talking about. So on the sunward side, it could extend out far enough where we could connect into Jupiter, the comet, Venus, and then our new moon passing, all of this happening. We could connect in beyond in the solar system electrically all the way beyond Venus, and we could connect all the way out beyond Jupiter. And once this electrical charge starts flowing, we could have some real fireworks going on and electrical connections to this comet. So once again, what are the possibilities of this happening? I would say pretty good. We're going to see some effects. Are we going to see, I talked a number of shows ago before Christmas, about the red hand of death, the sulfur dioxide that comes from Jupiter. When the big comets come in and connect all the way out to Jupiter, they're bringing in that sulfur dioxide, the red poison from Jupiter, and it can come into our atmosphere. Will Mars see the red hand of death? Will we get some red atmospheric effects on Mars due to the influx of sulfur dioxide? That's a very good possibility, starting in mid-September of next year. I wonder if NASA will shut off their Mars rovers before all of this starts to happen. That's going to be an interesting thing to watch in itself. What is NASA's reaction? Are they going to, all of a sudden lose communication with their rovers up there once this starts to happen, because they would have a bird's eye view of the ground effects, of the chemicals coming into the atmosphere, the winds, the other storm systems, the potential water coming in. It's all very interesting. We're in the last minute of the show here. I just want to remind you, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. And remember that this is a commercial-free show. I pay for it, and if nobody purchases anything, I still pay for this show. But I have some great things there, the pre-filter, the modular storage filtration system, my own products. Go and learn about them at the webpage. The Recalendar Sun-Star Clock, something you will not find any other place on the planet. Go to the webpage, to my books, DVDs, and a lot of information there. This is a lot of information that you will just not find anyplace else. This is Jim McCanny. Once again, the webpage, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo, seven letters, JMCCSCI.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.